Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome to Teach Me to Talk with Laura and Kate. I'm Laura Mize, pediatric speech-language pathologist, and I'd like to welcome you to our show. Kate, are you there?
I'm here. Yay. I was even, 47 seconds early today, so I'm on top of it. How are
You're
you doing?
Doing great. I'm doing great. I am so excited about today's show because we have a very special guest who will be joining us. But before she gets on, let me just take care of some kind of housekeeping duties. Today's Friday, September 19th, 2008. It's 1 o'clock Eastern Time. And if you're listening right now, you're listening live. But you can also listen to the show at my website, teachmetotalk.com, or download us on iTunes for free. And the reason we're so excited today is because we have our special guest, our good friend Michelle Wilder, who is a physical therapist. Michelle, are you there?
I'm here.
Good.
Yay! Welcome,
you nearly
Michelle.
Gave me a heart. Yeah. You did nearly give me a heart attack. I wasn't sure if you were going to get here.
I'm here. I'm sorry.
That's okay. Well, today
I'm really good at signing on right when she says, "Are you there?" That's why I said, "Just give it that 'Are you there?' thing," and she'll say, "I'm here." It works.
I am here. I just got held up with the baby for a second.
Oh, well, that's understandable.
It is. Yes. Michelle has four children, but she's also a physical therapist, and she is joining us today to talk about muscle tone differences in children with developmental delays. And we're a featured show on Blog Talk Radio today, and for some reason the folks there retitled the show to say something like differing tones or something that when I read it I thought, oh my gosh, what is that? But for those of you who are listening, it's muscle tone differences. And Michelle's going to explain all of that to us today, since that is beyond my educational background as a speech pathologist. We, of course, talk about muscle tone and no muscle tone, but not like physical therapists do. So that's why Michelle is here today, so she can explain all of this to us.
Sure. Well, we can start with low muscle tone. That is often referred to as hypotonicity, and that is where babies in particular will feel floppy, for lack of a better word. And basically, there's a very low resistance to passive stretch. So if you took a baby's arm and you moved it, you wouldn't feel the resistance you would feel in a child who maybe had normal muscle tone.
They do. Babies with low muscle tone do feel different to me, though. When I pick them up, you can tell. Just there's a qualitative difference there, and they do feel a little bit lumpy, not being offensive.
And that's exactly right.
That's my turn. He's lumpy. Yeah,
yep.
It just
lumpy
means kind of they don't. Or yeah, floppy. I guess that's the unofficial official term, isn't it, Michelle? I did a little pre-reading so I wouldn't sound too stupid because
no.
This is really out of my realm of expertise. But
no.
I decided to read, and that's what they floppy baby syndrome, which.
Well,
I don't,
and every time I say it, I feel like, oh, that's a terrible way to label a child. But that's really what you feel like. So if you were to take a baby.
What would be nicer, like loose or something?
Like loose.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And really, when you feel a baby's muscle who has low tone, it just doesn't feel, it almost feels doughy or soft opposed to a child who has typical muscle tone. So so you can typically, in a child who does have significant or, you know, pretty obvious low muscle tone, you'll just notice a difference, even if you don't know how to explain it. You'll notice, even as a child's getting older, if you go to lift a baby, let's say, under, you know, his or her arms, it'll feel like you could just keep going and not catch underneath their shoulders, if that makes sense. And so that's one of those things that that's kind of indicative of low muscle tone.
Okay.
So
now talk about the other end of the spectrum, high muscle tone.
High muscle tone is really that increased stiffness, meaning that is where maybe you could even move. Let's say you were going to bend or straighten an elbow. You could move it, but it would just you'd almost feel like that body part is stiff. And kids that are higher muscle tone sometimes have what's called spasticity, and that is that can impair function sometimes. It just depends on how high or how spastic you know, they are. But, you know, sometimes children will just look stiff, and sometimes they really have a hard time even just doing volitional movement, meaning, you know, moving themselves independently. So,
okay, I'm gonna play dummy, which I seem to do weekly, so I'm really good at that.
Go ahead.
Okay, I want to ask you this, Michelle, because, I'm going to, well, I want it for my own information. But
sure.
Anyway, You know, I've seen kids, and they may or may not have some official diagnosis. It depends kind of when I come on the scene. But, and I've thought this before, like you go to see, can he reach his arm as he's sitting up, and you try and kind of help him, and you feel like it's really stiff, and it could almost crack.
Correct.
Is that spasticity?
That would be spasticity. Spasticity, it's really with all forms of tone, you almost have to just keep feeling it over and over, you know, to really delineate it. It's hard to put into words. But basically,
okay,
the spasticity piece, that is when kids are really spastic. Sometimes they're just not even able to really move well, and sometimes medication will be used to help break that up. So it depends on the level of it. But what you're explaining is, you know, is what I'm talking about when I say spasticity. Almost that feeling like you're going to hurt them if you bend
right,
your elbow too much.
Like you might think he's trying not to, but then you realize it's not necessarily intentional. He just is stuck there, kind
right.
of. And you're thinking, it's not really moving the way I would expect it to. Okay.
Exactly. And kind
okay.
of the technical, you know, for spasticity, the technical definition is just like a velocity-dependent resistance to passive movement. So it means like if you're going to go move their let's say their arm real fast, like bend their elbow real quickly, then you would almost feel like you said you were gonna hurt them, that you would
okay.
you know almost break it. And so that's kind of that feeling that you get as a therapist or as a parent, you know, when you try to move a child who is more spastic.
Yeah, the feeling I get is, ooh, I think we might need PT in on this one.
Right. That's probably a good thing to think.
That's a good feeling, isn't it?
That's right.
Maybe beyond my scope of practice.
That
okay.
is true.
Yeah.
And
okay.
so some kids that have, you know, whose spasticity is pretty prevalent, and it kind of depends on the muscle groups. You know, sometimes they'll see their orthopedic surgeon and perhaps do Botox injections or you know, or there's some kind of medication that they can go on, you know, orally, which would mean it would be systemic, and there's side effects to that, too. Sometimes kids will get kind of sleepy or almost too far the other way, but that's what, you know, a physician's going to manage that medical part.
Okay.
And that's for kids with high muscle tone. For
that's
low
high
muscle
tone.
Right.
Yes.
And low muscle tone, talk about that for a little bit, because I think actually when the children that I see with speech-language delays, I would see lots more children with low muscle tone than I would with high muscle tone.
Absolutely. And that's really, I mean, even as a PT, when I go in, just in general, most of the kids I see typically have low muscle tone.
Right.
And again, that doesn't mean that I don't have children who do. But a lot of kids just with, you know, kind of that unknown reason why they have, you know, gross motor delays, a lot of those kids do have lower tone. And really, it's harder for them to work, meaning they just don't move as efficiently. A lot of times their reaction time is less, meaning like if they're sitting and they go and they start to lose their balance and fall over, they might not put their hand out as quickly to catch themselves. Their balance just isn't as good as maybe a child with typical muscle tone, or their coordination just isn't the same. And I think usually parents kind of pick up on that. They might not say hypotonicity or low muscle tone, and they might not even really. Sometimes the low muscle tone is fairly subtle, meaning it doesn't feel quite as floppy as what we were describing earlier, you know.
Right.
But they will notice, like, something's off. You know, they may have another child or see other children and be like, you know, they can't keep up with the other kids. And that's usually that lower muscle tone
Now, why is that? Why do you think, what are the reasons kids could have low muscle tone or high muscle tone? What are those reasons?
It can be associated with a syndrome, which, you know,
okay.
like children with Down syndrome. Those children have low muscle tone, or Prader-Willi
right.
syndrome. And sometimes there are just, you know, from my experience, sometimes we just never know why. It might be genetic, you know, it might, there's kind of a whole medical piece that I don't think you really wanted me to go into, but, you know, or a whole, you know, it could have to do with like lower motor neurons, you know, more of the neurology piece. But the fact of the matter is that for some reason they have low muscle tone, and that's usually when I refer a child on to, you know, a neurologist or their pediatrician, and they need to kind of uncover the reasons. You know, is there a syndrome that needs to be discovered, or is it just the way that they were made? Yeah, because the fact is we all have muscle tone. Some of us have lower muscle tone, some of us have higher muscle tone, and so that whole scope of normal, you know, is out there. So you have to decide if it's something that's going to impair their function long term, or is it just something that you can work through.
Right. And, you
know,
I told
you. Oh, go ahead.
You go ahead.
Okay, I'll go ahead. We interrupt each other constantly, but with three, it could be really bad.
I know. I was just thinking that with three really big talkers.
I was going to say.
Really. My turn. Okay, I want to slow you down on that muscle tone, the low tone, the hypertonicity part. Sounds like to really, for a PT to be sure or to feel reasonably certain that, yeah, we're looking at low tone here, you're going to move the child. But I just wondered from a, you know, a less professional opinion like mine, perhaps, is there anything, like if you walk in and you just kind of look at a kid and you might watch them a little bit, are there telltale signs that are kind of cue and not necessarily to make that call, but to make you think, probably
absolutely.
Just go through a few of those things.
Okay, yeah. So some are just that rounded trunk, meaning let's say you see a child sitting on the floor and they have something called the posterior pelvic tilt, which is where they just look like they're sitting, their pelvis is kind of rolled underneath them and they're flexed forward, meaning their trunk is rounded forward. And that.
Now go back and use more real words for that.
Okay.
Sitting down, so that means they're kind of humped over, right?
Yep,
is that what
basically
you think? Their little
bellies
stick out? Okay.
Yep, a lot of kids with low muscle tone, their bellies look maybe a little distended. Their abdominal muscles aren't as strong, so they look a little distended. Their head may be forward. Their shoulders may be rounded, you know, forward. A lot of kids who have low muscle tone, as they get older, they'll W-sit, which is where you can kind of envision, let's say you were kneeling on the floor with your bottom back on your heels, and then your calves or your shins are on the outside of your thighs. I don't know if you can visualize that or not.
So you're making a W with your leg.
Yeah, well, you're making a W with your
feet pointed out. Yeah, we see that all the time. Yeah.
Yep, feet pointed out. You know, their bottoms might be on the floor, maybe on the back of their heels. But, you know, and a lot of children do W-sit, but your kids, you know, that kind of fall into that position more than not. You know, those kids, that can kind of be a light, you know, light can kind of go off and you can kind of realize that that's, you know, they might be doing that because it's more of a stable position, meaning for a child with low muscle tone, they feel more stable. They have to work less to keep their trunk upright if they're sitting in that position versus a ring sitting position, which would be where their bottom was on the floor and their legs were kind of just forward in front of them with their knees bent.
Like an Indian, sit like, or crisscross after.
Crisscross, or if their heels were just.
You got to pull it way back. Okay.
So if they're sitting, ring sitting, what we mean by that is think of your bottom on the ground, legs out in front of you, knees slightly bent, maybe feet are touching, maybe not necessarily crisscross applesauce, but, you know, their legs are forward in front of them.
Okay.
So, you know, the lower tone kids typically, like I said, W sitting, rounded forward, you know, just in general, they find kind of the easier way out. Like, let's say instead of kneeling with their, you know, with their bottom off their heels, like just tall kneeling is what that's called, they might always be sitting back on their heels or leaning against something for support.
Well,
you know,
I was
and it
about to say that. Leaners, I think that I've had so many kids, I sit down and they automatically just somehow drape themselves over my legs.
Yeah, exactly.
Or on my arms, yeah.
Or if you stand a child up, you know, against, like, if you stand them up at a couch and instead of maybe, let's say when they're a new stander, they stand and put their like, if they were standing and they were playing at the couch, instead of just having maybe one hand on the couch for support and playing with the other hand, they may be laying along, you know, where their belly's up against the couch and their hands are free. Or, you know, they're just more leaning up against things and propping themselves. So it's not always obvious. And I think the big thing to remember is that we all have muscle tone, but those kids that maybe aren't meeting their milestones like you'd expect, and then they're doing some of these other things we're talking about, you know, those are your kids that, you know, that probably do have lower muscle tone, and you just don't want to miss that, meaning, you know, maybe that's the time you have to go see, you know, talk about it more with the pediatrician or neurologist and see if there's a reason for that or if it's just a genetic predisposition and it's something that they'll work through. And when I say work through, I don't mean necessarily change it, but meaning that you maybe just need to try different things to try to make them work a little bit harder to build up that strength that they need to move on to new milestones.
Well, let me ask you this, and we've had this conversation a lot, and you always say great things that make me understand this. Can we truly fix low muscle tone or high muscle tone? And I know that you talked about that whole medical piece before for kids with high muscle tone.
Right.
But with low muscle tone, are you ever really going to, quote-unquote, fix that or heal that or make that completely normal?
No, that word gets used a lot. It often gets used interchangeably with strength, and those are two different things. So your muscle tone is your muscle tone, and that is really kind of the amount of resting, like the amount of tension or resistance you have in that just muscle, that rest. So a strength is really like the ability for that muscle to produce a force, meaning to really contract and move. So basically, you can change strength, but your tone is pretty much, you know, your tone is what you are, is what you have, basically.
Okay.
So your kids with lower tone, well, sometimes people will use it, you know, oh, their tone feels better, but a lot of times what people are really referring to is just they're getting stronger, and so their strength is better, and so it appears that they're, you know, their tone is getting better. It's kind of confusing, but basically when you are working on things, you're really wanting to improve their strength is what you're meaning to say. I don't know if I made that more confusing or not, but
no, that makes really good sense to me, because to kind of think about tone as you can fix muscle tone, or you can exercise enough and that little kid's body is not going to be as floppy. Again, that's not because his tone has really changed.
He's just getting stronger. Yeah, and as your muscles get stronger and they support your joints better, you know, your movement patterns will look better. So a child who has hypotonicity or low muscle tone, they typically have more movement in their joints. Their range of motion may be excessive, meaning greater than normal, you know, where instead
so
of just
So they look like they can do the splits or something.
Right,
there. Yeah.
Right. And that isn't something that you want to encourage. A lot of people think it's neat when, you know, a child with low muscle tone can get in and out of sitting doing the splits. Well, that's not good.
Okay, so
you don't want
why wouldn't you want to do that?
Because basically it's teaching, you know, that pattern is not appropriate. Like, let's say you have a child who's sitting and their legs are straight out to their sides, and then they move on to their belly with their legs still out to their sides and then come back up. And I've seen children do that. They're just moving in one plane, and they're not using any trunk rotation, meaning they're not having to, you know, use their abdominal muscles, like their oblique muscles, like we want them to. You know, it's not, you don't want to keep, their ligaments are already a little bit more lax than a child with typical muscle tone. You don't want to encourage that position for them.
Okay, and you don't want to do that because there could be long-term damage from that? They can really damage those ligaments and things, or are you just saying you just want to promote better movement patterns?
You want to promote better movement patterns, but let's say you don't want – basically your bone growth – when you're standing in an appropriate position, like let's say you're standing without your shoes on. If you're standing on the inside borders of your feet, and this is a child, let's say, who's walking already, but they're standing on the inside of their feet and they're not positioning their feet very well, then what happens is the forces that are going through up through their legs are atypical, meaning they're not going through their legs the way you'd want a child who's growing and maturing, you know, to be standing. So then it might put increased force on the medial or inside aspects of their knees, change the position of their hips. And, you know, again, it's not that kids can't walk and do things appropriately in that position, but long term you're promoting atypical movement patterns and atypical growth. So, and I actually just went to a course this weekend that talked about that, as far as you grow, you know, your femurs, which are your thigh bones, are medially rotated, but as you grow and mature, they kind of come out more. It's called hip torsion, but basically you want your hips, your femurs, your thigh bones to be seated in your hips properly, and if they kind of maintain that position that's atypical, that can you know, cause orthopedic problems or arthritic changes later on that could be prevented.
That's what I was getting at. What's going to be that long-term damage? You're more at risk for arthritis. You're more at risk for any of those kind of orthopedic. Would injury be the right word?
Well, yeah, that would probably be the right word. And I think the thing to remember here is that doesn't mean that every child that walks on their, you know, their inside of the medial borders of their feet are going to develop these problems. But it's kind of like anything else. Like, we all know that going to the dentist and flossing is a good idea for our general health. So why would you not make sure that your feet are positioned well? You know, why wait until there's problems before you do it? And so if I have a child that I know is, you know, is more likely to maybe, you know, if they have low muscle tone and they're more likely to develop these patterns, I'd rather correct it before it becomes a problem. And I saw this even with my adult patients who had typical muscle tone when I was working in a clinic with adults, I mean, a lot of times back pain and knee pain would resolve or at least decrease if we corrected the position of their feet. And so
okay.
I don't know if I'm wandering into other territories, but it's a whole kinetic chain. Everything that happens, you know, down at your feet affects the rest of your body, and you just want to make sure that you're positioned as close to normal as possible.
Okay. Well, let's go back to that W-sitting thing because
I
think that's something that we see with lots of children. Don't you agree, Kate?
Absolutely. Very high percentage of my kids do.
Me too. And over my whole career, too, this isn't something that just kind of happened. And I think I W-sat as a child, but I think I'm on lower end of muscle tone if you're looking at normal. Not so low that I'm non-functional because, of course, I can talk, I can walk, I can sort of run, you know, those things. So my point is with the W-sitting,
correct.
We know they do that because they want to get more support. It's easier for them to keep their little bodies in that sitting position longer. But
right.
we should correct it because we don't want them to develop those changes that you talk about later. You know, we know that they would be more prone for arthritis or injury or whatever you want to call it. So what are how should kids sit? If we have a parent out there who's listening who has a kid who sits in that W position often,
mm-hmm.
how should they sit? What would be better for them?
What I would say is, so if they're W sitting, usually we use a cue like fix your feet or fix your leg, you know, find some verbal cue that works best for your child, and you'd want them to at least bring one leg around so that it's in front of them. So you could do something called side sitting. So even if that one leg is still in that W position, the other leg is out in front of the child. So you could be, does that make sense, a side sitting position? Or just tell them to fix their feet entirely and they can bring their legs both in front of them, either into a ring sitting position or a long sitting position. And honestly, more than even the orthopedic piece, I think, you know, because that again is, there's different theories on that. Some people feel it stunts, you know, orthopedic growth, or not. I don't want to say that stunts the orthopedic growth, but let's say that it can harm you more than others. I think even more important than that is just that kids are not having, they're not basically working the way they should be working in that position. So, you know, you want their trunk to be strong enough that they can hold themselves up without locking down into that position. And that's really more important because if you're sitting properly and you're doing good trunk rotation, you're strengthening your abdominal muscles and your obliques. And that carries on to other activities. You know, you need your obliques for running and you know, your arm swinging is what I'm talking about there. Like if you're going to have good trunk rotation while you're walking and running and doing other things, you have to start working on those muscles even while sitting and crawling and, you know, your early milestones.
Right,
so.
And it's important for speech, too, because the kids who are humped over, like we've been talking about, whose little bellies are out and their shoulders are down and they look like they're, again, kind of, you were calling that, I think you said pelvic, blah, blah, blah. But when they're bent over like that, they do not have enough breath support to really support long phrases, sentences, because we talk with air that comes up from our lungs, that vibrates over our vocal cords and helps us make those sounds. And if you are all hunched over like that, you're not going to have enough breath support. So it really affects everything.
Well, and really, we all could probably benefit from abdominal exercises. I mean, a strong core, again, affects, you know, people with back pain, they have to strengthen their core. You know, people with, like you said, with speech issues, you know, your breath support relies on that. A strong, you know, your strong abdominal muscles as your diaphragm works off it. So I think when I think of low muscle tone and I think, you know, the reasons I want to help kids get into better positions and work harder is just for all those reasons. You know, if you sit and you're hunched forward, try to eat or talk, you know.
Right.
You can just do it yourself. I think whenever there's a question of, you know, if it's good or not, put yourself in that position and see how you feel. You know, W sitting, I mean, when I get up from W sitting, my, you know, the inside, the medial borders, meaning kind of the inner part of my knees, you know, hurt. Does that mean that something permanent or, you know, awful has happened to my knee joint? You know, not necessarily, but it's not a comfortable position, and long term it can't be good for you, you know. So that's why you want to discourage those positions. And we all have habits that we kind of get into and they're hard to break. So if I see a 2-year-old doing that, I'd rather break it then than break it when they're 7 and they're on the floor, you know, playing like that still. And that's like you said, for speech, I mean, if you're already at a disadvantage, meaning you're already, let's say, behind on, you know, in speech, you want to correct those things as quickly as you can.
Right.
Right. Okay, I have another one for you, Michelle.
Sure.
You talked some about, or mentioned anyway, about those developmental milestones, and you're talking mostly gross motor stuff. You know, when
sure.
did they sit? When did they crawl or creep or whatever you want to call it?
Right.
When did they stand? When did they walk? And what I want to ask you is with hypotonic or kids with low tone or their most loose kids, do they tend to be late or a little behind or maybe a lot behind on all of those things? Or is there any pattern to that? I mean,
well, that's, you know, it kind of depends on, it really does depend on the amount, you know, how low their tone is. Meaning,
okay.
like a lot of the children I work with who have Down syndrome, the typical or the average age for a child to walk with Down syndrome is 2 years old. Now, I still have kids that have maybe start at 19 months, and I still have kids that might not walk till, you know, 2.5 years. So that's, again, an average. But I do see a delay in that, and I think the hardest part for a lot of kids with low muscle tone, and this is significantly low, is what I'm talking about. Kids have the hardest time learning how to crawl or to creep is what we call it, which is when you're on your hands and knees. So a lot of kids kind of get stuck working on that for a while.
Okay.
And they might like to stand, and they might like to, you know, stand at the couch and play, but the creeping piece is so hard for them that it seems like that's where we get hung up, and that's where it takes longer. You know, that's the skill that we get hung up on. You know, usually 6 to 8 months-ish, you know, is where we're working on that, and it feels like it's never going to come. But, again, with low muscle tone, you know, you really have to – they're having to work very hard, and they're having to really work on their core muscles, which aren't necessarily working as efficiently as they should, and then that's just a hard pattern to learn. And kind of going back to why you want to correct – you know, like your W sitting position and such, your muscles, if your muscles are in a position where they cannot work as effectively, it's that much harder for a child to work. So let's say you're sitting in that W sitting position. Your glutes, the muscles on your bottom, they're overstretched in that position. So it's harder for them to fire and work. So if you already have a child who, let's say, has some underlying weakness, you want to put their body in the best position possible so that their muscles can work as efficiently as they can. Does that
even
make
if
sense?
Working means just sitting there, but they're sitting in a proper position, so therefore they're quote unquote working harder. Right?
Well, I'm saying yes. You want them to sit in the correct position so that the muscles that they are using or the muscles that are just like, let's go back to ring sitting. If they're ring sitting and they're just playing, and they are having to work harder than if they're W sitting because their trunk's having to work a little bit harder. But if they master that, in the long run, that's going to be better for them than being in that W sitting position where they might not have to work as hard and they look a little more stable. But if you're in a W sitting position and your glutes are, I won't go into all the names of the muscles, but some of your muscles,
don't.
Are, okay? Some of those muscles are overstretched.
You can just say butt and
your
leg.
Butt. So if you're in a W sitting position and your butt muscles are stretched so they're lengthened, it's almost like they get overstretched. Then when you get up to standing and walking, those muscles are they're already overstretched, so it's harder for them to – they're not as strong as they should be for that reason also. So overstretching is not always good. Or some muscles that are shortened too much, they don't get they don't contract and work as well as they should either. So there's just so many biomechanics, and I think, you know, there's so many reasons biomechanically why you want to promote, you know, good positioning. I mean, my children have typical muscle tone, but, you know, I see them W sitting sometimes, and if they do it once in a while, it's not a big deal, but my little boy who had speech issues, I noticed he did more than the other kids, and I would try to correct it, because I'd never wanted him to take the easy way out and it to cause more problems later on for him, if that makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah. It makes total sense. And when I have kids like that, and you know, I love the cues that you gave, fix your feet. I've said feet in the front.
Right.
What are some other ones that therapists might say or that parents might say at home? What are some other ones that you might
I would say have? Things like, you know, put your toes out in front of you. Like I'd pick a body part and tell them to, or tap your knee, tap your feet, you know, and tell them to put their feet in front of them so that they can reach over and tap them. I think the hardest thing, and this is one of the hardest things for me, is I want to manually. I want to fix things. You know, I want to go and move their feet for them or move their leg for them. And even though you can do that the first couple times to say, fix your feet and show them what you mean, you really need to try to rely less and less on the physical cues and more on, you know, the verbal cues. And that, you know, Laura, you've taught me too, just in general, things that if we want children to communicate and we want them to, you know, to learn simple commands and such, we really do need to step back and just give them the verbal cue and let them take over and do it themselves.
Right. And I don't think I do that enough with kids. Sometimes I think I am my little W-sitters, and I got a little bit of flack from the first DVD, Teach Me to Talk, where I let some kids W-sit the whole time I worked.
Oh, did you?
Because I was looking at them from their chest up. I wasn't really paying attention to those feet.
Well,
you know,
but I'll tell you, that's pretty normal. You know, and a lot of people, though, I mean, that's why you could get arguments kind of either way. I mean, some people, like, I'm probably making a bigger deal about W-sitting because I really do think it's, I do not think it's a good position for kids, and I can give you all these reasons why. But some people, I don't think, put as much focus on that. You know, they think, well, you know,
PTs do put a lot of focus on that. The teams that I'm on, anyway. Now you're on lots of the teams that I'm on and have been for a long time.
But I think
PTs and OTs talk about that, don't you, Kate? I know you work
with lots
of different teams.
Yeah, but I think some pediatricians or, you know what I mean, some other people, like in the whole big picture, they think, well, it's, you know, it's not as big of a deal. Like sometimes with bracing, I'll have to call and really explain why I want it. Because if the child's walking already, a lot of times people think, you know, that if I tell the family that I want to do bracing and they talk about it with their pediatrician or someone else, they might think, well, if they're already walking, it's okay. But I guess I'm thinking biomechanically long-term why I'm wanting them to do it, you know. And some families are, you know, some families just, they're already concerned, let's say, like you're saying about speech, and they don't want to worry about the W-sitting or not. But once you catch on and you see what I'm saying, you know, you see it, it's easier to correct. It's like anything else. Once you kind of get into the routine of saying, fix your feet, it's not a big deal. But as a therapist, sometimes when you give a family one more thing to do, it is a big deal. You know, they already have enough on their plate, and they don't want to have to worry about analyzing every position. But things even just like having a child, you know, maybe a two-year-old or an older child, if they're on their belly playing where they're propped on their elbows, that's a great position where their abdominal muscles are kicking in and they're getting good weight through their proximal muscles, meaning their shoulder muscles, and having to do some neck extension. You know, again, as an adult, just get in that position and do something for a while and you realize you're working and you don't always, you know, you might not even realize you are. And so that would be a great position to promote with a child.
And I try to do that with kids sometimes too, kids that won't look at me.
Right.
I will get down and lay on my stomach and try to kind of think, okay, I'm going to poke my head under where they're looking here and see if I can get them to look at me that way. And it is really working hard.
It is. It is. And I think what I learned kind of going through a lot of this is just, you know, put your own body in that position and see what's working, you know, and just see how you feel and see, you know, and that's how the child's feeling. So, I mean, you know, if you have a question, get in that position and see. Because, you know, a lot of times we think of even working on abdominal muscles just as doing, you know, people talk about doing sit-ups or therapy ball activities, and those are all great, but there's also other ways, like having a child, you know, on their belly and playing on their forearms. That's another great way to activate those muscles, and they don't even necessarily realize they're doing it. So
yeah, and that would be a good activity when you're not working on speech, because it's
going
to be hard to talk when you're laying down.
That is correct. That is correct.
Well, I want to throw another one out here for both of you. Those kids that I know I see, and you both must see routinely, where their face looks really loose, like their mouth is kind of open, and they're drooling. You know, a lot of times they're the big droolers, their shirt's all wet because they're drooling on themselves. And is that a tone issue also?
Yes. Yep. A lot of kids who have low muscle tone do maybe drool more than other children. And it kind of goes back again, like, does every kid who drools have low muscle tone? Not necessarily, but, you know, kids that maybe drool excessively or they drool in addition to some of the other things we've talked about, those
right.
are markers. I think that's, you know, I think you really need to look at the big picture, you know, because I don't want everyone who sees their child drooling to think that
think they have tone issues. But
same thing with puppy sitting or, you know, ring sitting.
Yeah,
or stuff.
It seems to me like a lot of those open mouths and then they're drooling, a lot of times their faces almost look kind of lumpy, loose, you know, like they don't have a lot of, like,
big,
you know,
floppy lips, big cheeks, baby. I think they look like they had baby fat, you know, in their face.
They do kind of more than other kids. Yeah, they look younger maybe or a little immature as far as their facial structure goes. But a lot of times they do have that loose, floppy belly that goes right along. You know, they kind of have those other things that you already talked about. But I just wondered, I've thought of that as tone in their face, but I didn't really know, is it really tone or is that something? I don't know. That's a good, I have a PT and a speech therapist to ask that question to.
And that's true. I mean, that is what you see.
What do the experts say about that?
Well, and I also think you need to think about kind of long-term with kids with the lower muscle tone. Once they start walking, you know, you still can look for those things like you were talking about as far as the drooling and positioning, you know, maybe trunk position and stuff while sitting. But then activities to do to really help children like that are, you know, a lot of climbing and a lot of playground activities and really to keep working on that because, Laura, I mean, I think that's what you would say you need for those kiddos that are still behind speech-wise. They need to keep, you know, just because a child starts walking, you don't want to think, oh, okay, everything's better. You want to keep working on those activities.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that happens. You know, again, you know, I think that that's, I think everyone, me included, you know, it's exciting to see your child walking, but if you have a speech delay and you have that tendency to have lower muscle tone, you know, maybe nothing that indicates a syndrome or anything, but just in general, you have that lower muscle tone, you do want to promote those activities.
Right. And back to the diagnosis thing, we talked a little bit about kids with Down syndrome. We know that that's kind of part of Down syndrome and that's low muscle tone is associated with Down syndrome. But what other kinds of big diagnoses are associated with low or high muscle tone, Michelle?
Well, you can have spastic cerebral, you know, you can have cerebral palsy and have higher muscle tone or lower muscle tone or fluctuating muscle tone. Prader-Willi.
Oh, yeah, that's really fun where you think, oh, it's high tone. No, it's low tone. Oh, it's high tone. No, it's low tone. Yeah.
No, I've
exactly.
lost it.
Yeah, exactly.
It does, you need to go there next, Michelle, because it does vary sometimes.
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. And there's, you know, and that's another thing. You can have like an ataxic gait pattern, meaning it's fluctuating, you know, it's a little different. There's gait pattern.
Okay, go back for a second. Ataxic gait pattern. How would those kids look like they're walking? I think about that is they just look pretty clumsy or they almost kind of overreach to step. Is that what you're talking
about? Yeah.
Okay.
That's exactly right. And then a lot of times kids with really low muscle tone will have, they'll kind of, they'll have their legs spread apart, maybe more, you know, more than normal, maybe, their feet turned out, that's considered a wide base of support, which is where their legs just instead of, it almost looks like they're a new walker for a longer period of time. You know, every child when they start walking kind of has that wide base of support, their legs are spread apart, but, you know, a child with lower muscle tone may hang out in that position longer just for stability. They may keep their hands up, which is considered, is called high guard. Maybe their hands are up near their head or their shoulders while they're walking. And then, you know, kids with higher tone, I mean, they can have a crouch gait pattern, which is basically where their hips and their knees and their ankles are flexed or bent, so they almost look like, it looks like gravity's working pretty hard on them, meaning they have to, that position's just a whole other position. You know, they might appear more stiff, let's say. So many of these can just present themselves in so many different ways, you know, so many different muscle tone. But I think the lower tone, which is what most of the children that you and I see have, is more of that wide base of support, arms and high guard look.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about another pattern that lots of kids that we see have, especially kids that are on the autistic spectrum, that would be toe walking. Talk to us about that.
Toe walking.
It's not really a tone thing, is it?
No. Well, that can kind of, let me back up a little bit. Some kids with, let's go back to hypotonicity, so low muscle tone.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes it will be, you know, you might feel like that floppy feeling or they might feel kind of loose, a child will, or they'll have these presentations like when you look at them with the, you know, let's say the forward head or the rounded shoulders, rounded trunk. But then sometimes some kids with low muscle tone or a lot of times, let's say they're on their belly, they will straighten their arms and lock them into that position. And you'll think, oh, they're so strong. Look, they're holding, you know, they're holding themselves up so well. But what their muscles are not necessarily doing all the work, but they're locking their elbows so that their bones or their joints are kind of locked straight so they have to work less.
So they're kind of compensating for that.
Yeah, exactly. They're compensating.
Okay.
So, and that can happen sometimes with kids too when they're walking. You know, their knees may be locked straight, so they almost have a stiff presentation even though they have low muscle tone. So that can all get kind of tricky depending on the child and how they're compensating. Does that make sense?
And that could be where a low tone kid actually kind of looks like high tone, but it's not really high tone because he's just compensating for the low tone.
Right, by locking
right.
the
okay.
joint straight. And so go back to your question because you know I start talking and I just forgot what your question
was. I think I forgot what it was too. But it's not toe walking.
Okay.
That's not related to tone because for this one little guy that I'm thinking about, I have a little guy who's toe walking right now, and his physical therapist had talked about initially how tight he was, and she thought he was toe walking because of how tight he was, and I think he's toe walking because it's a sensory thing.
No, and that's it.
Okay.
That's the thing is sometimes kids, what they'll do is if they kind of have poor body awareness, they just have some sensory issues, and that can be present, you know, like you were talking about with autism. Kids will walk on the balls of their feet, so they'll bring their heel up off the ground and walk. And if you just, again, do it yourself, you'll feel you kind of get that deep input through the balls of your feet. So if you have a child is not real sure of where they are in space, if they push up on the balls of their feet and then walk, they feel they get that sensory input is just stronger, or they feel it more.
They know where they are. They know, okay, I can feel my legs, my body is straight, I am moving forward. It just gives them more of an oomph.
Yeah, and so what I would do with a child like that, you know, there's different things you can try. Sometimes people put kids in high tops, let's say, just to kind of, it's harder to get up on your toes in that position. But I've had good luck with maybe putting little, very light weights on their ankles just to give them that input, and their heels will come down on the ground, but they'll have that extra input while they're walking.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. I haven't seen any other PT. Any kids that you've done that with, but I kind of like that idea.
Actually, I'm about to do it with a kiddo that we all see pretty soon.
Oh!
Because that's the same child, remember? She's the one that the OT tried some wrist or some hand weights, I think, with.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And she
mm-hmm.
responded well to that. So sometimes we do that.
I don't know that I ever see that little girl toe walk. I mean, that's so beside the point. We'll have to talk about this later.
But sometimes that'll be done just to give, again, kids with poor body awareness or decreased body awareness, you know, that'll just give them more input. And she's one of those kids that maybe looks a little, you know, not as coordinated, and we'll just see. And I think a lot of this is really, it's child to child and, you know, having a lot of tools in your box and trying them with, you know. I mean,
right.
I'm not alarmed every single time I see a child leaning forward, you know, rounded forward or W sitting or whatever, but it's really looking at the whole child and seeing what's functional, what's not functional, and is this hurting other areas of development.
Well, let's talk about that with functional for a minute, and we can mm-hmm. specifically, I sort of want to direct it more towards speech, so Michelle, you may not be able to help
no,
me
go ahead.
Out here, but there's so many studies right now, and it's kind of controversial. I don't know if you've been to my website lately, but I've got this article, this series on oral motor exercises. And so many therapists kind of live and die by those exercises because they really, really think that wiggling your tongue is going to somehow make your speech a lot more intelligible. And the research tells us that doing those oral motor exercises without any resistance and doing those exercises, if you don't do them to the point of fatigue, that you're not really helping those muscles. So from your perspective, you know, with strengthening exercise, I mean, what do you think about that, just from what you know about muscles and what you have to do to really make muscles stronger?
I mean, repetition, you know, repetition of the activity that you want. And I probably shouldn't speak for speech, but are you talking about, like, therapists, like speech therapists who really work on whistles and straws and stuff? I mean, honestly,
the research right now with all this, and I probably should have warned you about this.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been awesome.
Perhaps.
The research in the last few years that talks about this says if you want intelligible speech, if you want clearer speech, you better be working on speech
right.
and not on all of those other wiggles, doing all of those other things, because speech is specialized in your brain. At a different part in your brain than, say, just that. Speech requires another
Right.
Do you know
and
what I'm
honestly,
saying?
If
I mean,
that's what you're reading,
you're
I would, you know, it sounds like that, it sounds like the research is supporting, like, what you're saying then, as far as.
Yeah, the research is supporting that, and it's saying that even if you were looking at it from a muscle perspective, you could never exercise your lips or your tongue or your cheeks to the point that you would actually gain true strength.
Okay.
Because it would take so many repetitions and resistance, and we just can't do that with little kids' mouths.
So are they saying not to do it, or is there, what's
saying
the...
not to do it, and they're recommending
oh, really?
To work on it with just speech. You know, to work
huh.
on the if so that if you're working on if your end goal is intelligible speech, you need to accomplish those things with words and with sounds, not to just isolate the muscle movement, that it doesn't always carry over to intelligible speech.
Okay. Well, I mean,
but,
if that's what the research is saying, I guess what I'm thinking.
I'm going to argue about this.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'm thinking if I'm thinking more. Just in general, like what do a lot of my kids with low muscle tone kind of need? And a lot of them
right.
need to gain better core strength, meaning your trunk strength and kind of proximal strength, like let's say shoulders and hips. That's what we're talking about when we say proximal. I mean, I think that would make sense that the kids would still need to work on those muscle groups with speech delays for the breast support if that's part of
the problem.
Oh,
I totally
you know?
Think that. I totally think that,
yeah. Yeah, and honestly, I mean, if that's what it's saying, then I guess I would have to just, you know, agree with it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I haven't looked at enough, right, you know, as far as just
right.
oral motor.
But, like, when you're working with a kid just with strengthening kind of overall body or strengthening
yeah.
particular things, the things that you recommend are lots of repetitions and that you
right.
do it against resistance, right?
I do, yes, against resistance. And I would definitely say that doing a lot of repetitions is really the key, because I think I see a lot of times, and I'm included, you know, we get very excited, let's say, when we see a child squat to stand off the floor by themselves, and they don't hold on to anything, and that is great, but you don't need to just do it once. You know, that child needs to be able to
right.
do it multiple times, so when they're walking and they trip over something, and they kind of, you know, they fall down, let's say, and they squat to catch themselves, or, you know, they put their hands on the floor to catch themselves, so they can come back up independently. So, I mean, I'm always very much about repetition and in working on whatever skill you're working on over and over. And even though I celebrate when kids do something well, I don't want – there's never a time where I just think, oh, that's done, you know, move on, you don't need to work on that anymore. Those skills, I think, really need to be integrated into their home program. You know,
well,
walking up
– oh, go ahead. Well, one thing I think that you're great at, and I try to do this with speech, but I know you're great at this with PT, is you celebrate for about 1 minute, and then you
yes.
move them on to the next level. You
yes.
think, okay, this is what we're going to do next. Great. All right, here's the next thing. Here's what makes that even more difficult.
Exactly.
You keep them kind of going. Yeah.
Well, and that's what I have one dad who had got on me about that, and he's like, would you just enjoy the moment. Like, I did. Moment's done. We must move on.
Not
but
why I'm here.
True.
Yeah.
Right. But I do think, you know, like let's say I have a child that's walking and their balance is improving, then I might make it a little bit more challenging for them by having them carry different objects, you know, maybe awkward objects, you know, maybe heavier objects like Pilates balls. I use those a lot. That's a great way for kids to challenge their balance and to have to use their abdominal muscles and their core muscles to, you know, to stay upright and move well. I mean, all those things, I just don't think you should ever just, and from my perspective, I don't just ever cross it off a list. Like, oh, core strength's perfect, let's move on. You know, because it's
right.
There's always, you know, there's always more things. I guess function is important, but then quality of movement's important. And I don't like to see a child, like I said, let's say walking on the inside borders of their feet and just say, oh, good, you're walking, you're done. I mean, I want them to walk well and to walk, you know, with their feet positioned appropriately and, you know, good heel-toe gait pattern. And you know, I could go on about that, but.
And this is something else I wanted to go back to, and we're nearly at the end of this hour. Do you need to go, or are you okay?
I think I'm okay for a couple more minutes.
Okay. You were talking about before four activities for parents at home who might have kids with low muscle tone. You really talked about doing the things that we want to see all our kids doing, climbing, playing
right.
on the playground equipment. What other things do you recommend for toddlers and young preschoolers so that they can really help work on that strength and that coordination piece physically?
Honestly, I think like what I was just saying as far as carrying, like I love those little just small Pilates balls, and sometimes I'll just make little things like rice socks. You know, I'll put socks or rice and some socks, just like, or bean bags. You know, just try to find different objects that are fun for the kids, and you might play, you know, where they have to squat, pick them up, and throw them into a bucket, or a game such as that, or they have to stand and reach up high and maybe push onto the balls of their feet and then come down and put it in whatever object you're playing with. But a lot of squat to stand, a lot of reaching overhead, and things just climbing. You know, climbing at a playground obviously is fun for kids, but, you know, taking your cushions off your couch and just making a tower and letting them climb up that, or air mattresses I use a lot where you can put a lot of air in, or, you know, take air out, just to vary the amount, you know, how hard it is for the kids to climb up and down them, and just take an air mattress and prop it up against the couch and let them do it that way. Let me think of what else I really use a lot. I mean, basically, oh, wheelbarrow walking. That is excellent, and all kids can benefit from that. Putting, you know, having their child or having your child walk on their hands and hold them at their hips, and try to keep their trunk parallel to the ground and have them walk, you know.
Well, I'm glad you said hold them to the hips, because, you know, I have seen parents.
Yep.
That forget that they need to actually put another hand under their bellies and help them do it, and they're scooting the poor kid on his face.
Yeah, don't do that. That would be one thing not to do. Or,
so when you say wheelbarrow walk with a toddler, I want you to back up and tell us exactly how you would do it.
Okay, I would have the child on their hands, you know, belly facing the floor, you know, have them, let's say, put them on their belly, have them push up onto their hands, hold their hips. If they really are very strong, you can move down onto their thighs. But the thing is, you don't want to hold a child too low where their belly's sagging and it's almost on the ground. You want them to be able to hold themselves up and be pretty much parallel to the ground.
So if they can't do that, they shouldn't wheelbarrow walk yet?
If they can't do that, what I would do is I'd probably wrap one of my forearm kind of around like the front of their lower trunk, and then another hand supporting their chest, kind of at their sternum.
And you would use both hands to kind of hold them up.
Yep.
Like that, and then you're going to almost help them shift that weight to their hands.
Right. And let them walk forward. And sometimes I do it it's harder, but you know, it's harder for the kids initially, but have them walk upstairs in that way. You know, like, so I'll hold them and I'll have them walk up a flight of stairs.
That makes more sense to me than the floor, because I can see how a kid would think, okay, I'm supposed to go up this.
Yeah.
Whereas sometimes right in front of you, they're just going to fall. I would think they would just kind of fall down.
Oh, a lot of kids do, or they don't really know what you want them to do. You know, they're like, well, right. But if you can demonstrate it with another child, or if you can do it and, you know, have, like, the mom, you know, run up the stairs first, and, you know, you chase them, or, you know, do something that's fun, and then, like I said, on the stairs, you know, they're going to advance one arm at a time. And that, you know, that helps with core strength, that helps with fine motor skills, because you're really strengthening the muscles in their hands and helping with, you know, helping give them arches in their hands, you know, because they're having to work and shift their weight over their arms. And proximal strength is so important for fine motor skills, meaning their shoulder strength has to be strong in order to do fine motor skills well with their hands. So
in real people terms, if they don't have strong shoulders,
correct,
they could potentially have a problem learning to write.
Yes, and OTs are great people to ask about that. But yes, I mean, fine motor skills in general can be affected if you don't have good proximal strength, meaning if your shoulders aren't very strong. You know, my OT friends always kind of bring that up, and they're right. They remind you that you really need, you know, good shoulder strength in order to do the fine motor skills, which, you know, kids do every day, you know, as far as, you know, picking up things to eat, or, you know, writing, or, you know, depends on what stage they are developmentally. But, yes, that does impact it.
Okay, wait, I want to slow you back on this. We're going to be out of time, but I want to know for my own sake. When you're doing the wheelbarrow walking with kids who are just beginning to do it, still, you know, don't really have what it takes to do it, where you're really just holding up the hips, and you said you put one kind of under your hands under the belly, one up kind of by their sternum. Uh-huh. Are you on your knees, Michelle?
Typically, that's how I do it. Like, my knees, I'm on my knees with them, and it's easier if their legs, like, if their legs are, I have a knee on either side of their legs. So their legs are kind of in the center, and then my legs are on either side.
So are their legs between your legs straight out?
Yes. You know, straight out meaning, yeah, I wouldn't have their legs absolutely, you know, touching, but they'd be straight out that way. And the big thing is, if parents are doing, is to make sure that they're not hurting their backs. You know, I see a lot of families trying to do it, and they're kind of, they're standing and they're leaning over and they're,
yeah, that would be me. Yeah,
I've done it. That's why I thought, I'll bet she's on her knees.
Yeah.
Because when I've done it, I'm pretty tall, and those, you know, 2-year-olds pretty short. And I'm leaning over thinking, oh, my gosh, I'm so glad I'm not a PT.
Yeah.
Well, but you can do it better. That's the thing for the parent. I think it's easier going up the stairs holding,
yeah,
it, you know, on my
that's
feet.
That's a good idea. I've never heard anybody say that. Have you heard anybody
neither.
Say that? Yeah.
Nope,
or
never.
Just
and it makes more sense.
Fun, mm-hmm, you know, like taking beanbags and, you know, just try to make fun things like that. And I do that with my you know, my kids all the time that I work with, but I started doing it more even at home with my kids just for fun. And, you know, kids, it's fun. You know, it's fun when your mom makes a pile of cushions on the floor. You know, you can make it a fun activity at night when everyone's playing in it. You know, I guess technically it's work for the child, but they don't necessarily pick up on it. Because PT, you know, kids get tired and they pick up pretty quickly on the fact that it's hard work.
Yeah.
So that's a good way into their day.
Well, and it's so good that you're trying to make it fun, because I think a lot of PTs, and Kate and I talk about this every week, a lot of early interventionists don't really get that fun piece and that playful piece, and it's so much work that the kid, you know, might start crying whenever they see you.
Oh, yeah, and that happens to me still. I've only had one child in, 7 years who's consistently not liked me for about 2 years, but
that's still pretty good, though.
That's really good.
But yeah. I would just say, you know, from my experience, most kids, you know, when you're working on hands and knees, like activities on your hands and knees and creeping or crawling, you know, creeping is actually when you're on your hands and knees, you know, moving forward. I mean,
it's what other people call crawling.
That is really hard work, and it's not fun. And, a lot of us don't like push-ups, and a lot of us don't like sit-ups. And so, it's hard work, and that's what kids are doing. So, you know, I try to find a balance. I mean, if kids are just, you know, try to make it fun so that it doesn't become an absolutely miserable experience. But I make every child, I think it's really important that they crawl, you know, or creep on their hands and knees. I think it's so important for kids to get that for just a multitude of reasons. And I know
give us some of those reasons. Give us like your top 3 or 4 reasons.
For core strength.
Okay.
You know, for core strength, meaning their trunk strength. For proximal strength, meaning their hips and their shoulders, because that, you know, impacts like I were talking about as far as their fine motor skills and really their gait. You know, they have strong hips. If their hips aren't strong, then, you know, they might walk with that wider base of support. I mean, for all those reasons, it's important. That reciprocal pattern, that coordination piece.
So I know that you know, every kid you see, because you work like Kate and I do in our state's early intervention program, you really don't let them go straight to walking. I mean, you back up, and even if they're liking to stand more, wanting to take some steps, you really do insist that they kind of crawl.
I do, yeah. Yes, and we all know someone who, you know, who didn't crawl and still walks fine. And so I think, you know, that's if I see a child who, I do everything I can to make sure that they do try to crawl, because I just think it really is important for them to get it for all those reasons we just, you know, just talked about. So, and sometimes if I have a child that really, really, really wants to stand, let's say, I'll let them crawl over to the couch and then they can pull the stand. You know, I don't make them crawl for an hour straight and make it a miserable experience, but if they really want to get over to those stairs, then we'll just make sure we crawl over to them, or, you know, and crawling upstairs is a great way to teach a child how to crawl. If they kind of figure out pretty quickly when you put them on the floor on their hands and knees what's coming next. But if you get them to some stairs and put maybe a toy that they really want a couple steps up and you work on crawling up the stairs to get to it, they typically will respond, you know, better to that strategy.
That's a good idea, too. You are all about using the stairs, aren't you?
I am. Stairs are a good thing. And you can just make stairs, you know, up to a couch. You can use stools or benches and, you know. Again, I guess I'd want to leave y'all not thinking that, you know, every child, like I said, who W-sits or does, you know, I see the reasons why I think kids really need to go through that. But I don't want to alarm any parents if their child does W-sit. Doesn't mean they're going to have, you know, any. It's just one of those things that I'd work on from here on out. You know, you're not guaranteed to have hip problems or knee problems or anything like that from W-sitting, because that's not necessarily the case. But, gosh, if I know that it's not helping them, I would definitely discourage it.
Okay, and let me ask you this. For any parents who are concerned that their child may have less low muscle tone and their pediatricians never mentioned it, do you think pediatricians kind of – is that something in your experience that they talk about readily, or parents should just kind of say, hey, I'm kind of concerned about this. What do you think?
I mean, I think it's always a good idea to bring it up to them.
Okay.
I think pediatricians, at least the ones that we work with here, I think they're very responsive to it. You know, I think that they would call if they saw low muscle tone, you know, if it was pretty significant. I think that they, I say significant or not significant, I think that they would say something. But I mean, I think in all fairness, sometimes during our well baby checkups or whatever, we're so busy going through so much that might not be noticeable. But I mean, I know the pediatricians we go to always move, you know, passively move them to check and see what they feel like. So I think it's done, but I think if it's a concern, I would definitely bring it up, you know, because you're okay. The one who's with them every day and sees how they sit.
Well, and we have about 30 seconds left, but I was going to say, I saw some statistics about even mild motor deficits with children, and about 30% of all toddlers with speech-language disorders also have mild motor disorders, too.
Hmm.
And Kate and I were talking about that, and we think the percentage is probably even higher than
higher,
that.
Higher, yeah. Probably.
Yeah,
that would
probably.
That would not be surprising. So.
Well, thank you so much, Michelle. You stayed with us the whole hour.
You are welcome.
And
it was, it wasn't scary, and you were really good at it.
Well,
it was just like talking on the phone, isn't it?
Yes, that was a lot of fun. Thank you, guys.
Thanks so much. We learned a lot, and I'm going to summarize all this stuff and put it on the website in an article, and I'm going to shoot you an email and let you look at it before I post it, just to be sure that everything is correct from your perspective.
Sounds fabulous.
Okay, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Michelle.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, everybody. Talk to you next Friday. Bye.
Okay, bye.